Tuesday night gamer edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Danny joining me to talk about the player that we presciently proclaimed as the greatest of all time on our 15 and 60 yesterday, Bojan Bogdanović.
It's great to see him do well. It helps when you play the Sixers.
Yeah, it did. And granted, you still have to be able to take advantage of the opportunities that you have.
For sure.
And he definitely did. He shot the ball really well from three-point range. He got up 27 shots, many of which were of the big-time heat check variety in the second half. But he was still extremely efficient, and they scored 131 points. So he definitely played extremely well, especially in the first half, in which he had 24 points, 9 of 9 from the field, and then overall 17 out of 27 for 44 points.
Channeling Mr. McDermott.
Yeah, from yesterday's game. And I mean, the number one reason that this happened, though, I don't think that this changes my opinion of Bojan that much overall. He took advantage of a Philly team that is really bad when they're all healthy and has been decimated by injuries. Both their starting forwards, Jeremy Grant and Robert Covington, are in the concussion protocol. They don't really have anyone to guard him who has the size. And we talked about his post-up game being a little disappointing. He actually really succeeded on those post-ups early and then also just was able to get out and transition for probably 6 or 7 pretty much uncontested layups or 2-on-1, 3-on-2 type of situations. And then he hit his threes. You know, that was really the only shots he made that were incredibly tough were some long twos down the end when he had scored so many points that he was just jacking up shots by that point.
And yeah, as you said, it's impressive to do this, even if it's against inferior competition. Well, and it's not that much inferior anyway. And
yeah, that's right. I mean, it's they beat the Nets last week, right?
Yeah, I believe 2 of Philly's 3 wins in conference were against the Nets.
But yeah, he, you know, it was good to see him at least get into the post. We talked about how he can be effective in transition for sure. You know, he's really good at leaking out. I mean, not the kind of guy you normally think of as a great transition player, but his numbers in transition are outstanding. And he just has a nose for getting out there and he'll run the floor hard. And, you know, whether it's for threes or even just for pretty easy layups. And it doesn't matter if you're not that explosive if there's nobody there to challenge you by that point.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like it's sometimes it can be a competitive advantage if you're, let's say you're defending a 2 or 3 who's more towards the corner, that if you just run harder than them, you can generate a look, as opposed to if you're kind of at the top of the key. I feel like that makes a bigger difference because it's a farther difference to run.
Yeah, and let's be clear, too. He was being guarded by Kendall Marshall was the guy that they were guarding him with when he had, like, you know, well over 30 points in the second half. Like, that was their attempt to go for a defensive stopper, and Kendall, bless his heart, not exactly known as a defensive stopper before he suffered a torn ACL, and it was Ish Smith who got switched onto him. I don't remember anyone larger than Marshall guarding him on any of his shots, basically, because they didn't have it. And then at the rim, other than Nerlens, it was Elton Brand and Carl Landry were the other bigs, because Rashawn Holmes is out too with Achilles soreness. So it's really, you know, getting to be pretty ugly, and this is a Philly team that hasn't nearly the spirit that they had down the end of last year, as we talked about yesterday. Also, our boy Sean Kilpatrick, 19 points on 11 shooting possessions, 3 of 4 on threes in this game.
That's great. I also should note Kevin Pelton was very excited because at one point the Sixers were not only playing 3 point guards, they were actually playing 4 point guards, which is pretty great.
He also got excited because Bojan was called for a 5-second backdown violation, the Mark Jackson rule, which is probably good for basketball, though even the year that it was implemented, it basically was implemented for 2 players. Remember, you can never change the rule for 2 players, right? Charles Barkley and Mark Jackson were really the only guys that it was implemented for. You basically just cannot back down for 5 consecutive seconds while dribbling, or it's a turnover. But anyway, all right, let's get to some of the games that affected the playoff race slightly more, starting with Indiana's 103-98 victory over the Celtics.
So early on, Boston was doing pretty well. I think they had it was about a 10-point lead. But what it looked like to me was that Indiana was getting looks and they just weren't going in. And when I see that, especially when a team is at home, I just feel like eventually it's going to regress to the mean, because generating open looks is more important in the early part of a game than making them in terms of its predictive power.
Yeah, there were really 3 big takeaways that I had in this game. One was just that the Pacers ran the same play over and over and over again, and the Celtics were completely powerless to stop it. Brian Scalabrine talked about this a little bit on the broadcast, that Paul George was being guarded by Marcus Smart, maybe Avery Bradley and Evan Turner a little bit, but mostly Smart. And Smart didn't do a horrible job on him at times. And at first, like the first possession of the game, George basically tried to face up on Smart from three-point range and tried to dribble, and he just got ripped and Smart came down for a layup. After that point, the Pacers really started just going to Paul George off of down screens on the weak side. And they would just set those screens. The Celtics weren't switching. The guy wasn't able to get through the screen, or it would be a handoff as well. And the Pacers were able to get to the middle every single time on those plays. And once you got in the middle, they were either able to throw it to the screener rolling in from the wing, or they could hit the opposite big when the help came, or no help would come at all, or George would hit a jump shot. And it just, they must have scored 20 times on that play alone, or gotten fouled 20 times on that play alone. And it was really disappointing for the Celtics to just get beaten that way over and over again. It got so bad in the third quarter that I was saying, look, like, I don't care who you have out there. If you're just going to give up a bucket every time in this play, you need to just switch that, because the guy's not getting through. There wasn't really any help from the big guy either. At least if you switch it, you're going to force a contested shot instead of something being wide open every time.
It's kind of amazing to think that a Celtics team would have to make that choice, because they've been so good defensively this year, but that's what happens when you're missing Jay Crowder, and he's such a huge part of what makes... We talked about earlier, I mean, when we're talking about all defensive players, and I asked you who would get the credit, and you said Jay Crowder, and the more I watch them, the more I agree with that.
Yeah, and this is an Indiana team that, as we know, is 24th in offense coming into this game. So they're not exactly a juggernaut, and since they've gone back to going big, they've been even less so. So that was one of my big takeaways. The other one was just that Smart-George matchup, which Smart started at the three, basically. It was Thomas, Bradley, and Smart all starting. I mean, Smart has the physical ability, really, to stay with some of these guys who are bigger than him just due to his physicality and his strength. And he tried the best that he could, but ultimately, Paul George got the better of him. He had 25 points on 16 shots in this game, and also really was very effective as a threat setting up others. And then the last thing I took away, too, for Boston's side was their bench really kind of got slaughtered in this game, which you don't expect to see from them since they're normally a deep team. But now that they're missing really their second and third best players, you could argue, with Olynyk and Crowder, you're now have to dig further into the bench. Terry Rozier was playing. They even brought in Cody Clark, a call-up from the D-League, who has a little bit of potential, but, you know, this is really his first NBA action that I can recall. You know, Tyler Zeller was playing more minutes. Evan Turner didn't have as much around him. Jonas Jerebko had to play 26 minutes, even though he had a pretty nice scoring game. So they had to kind of really get into the dregs of their bench a little bit more.
Something that was I found really interesting, but it does kind of fit in with what we're talking about, is that I think it was on the 15 and 60 we discussed how Indiana's rim protection and playing two bigs was going to have trouble with teams. And so I expected that to be more of something that would dissuade Boston. But according to the player tracking stats that they have now on NBA.com, Boston actually attempted 40 shots at the rim with a person nearby. So that's, you know, that's not the straight shot chart. That's the ones that are counted as defended. And Indiana had 20, but Boston shot a lower percentage. And they also drew less fouls and took fewer free throws. So it's kind of a different thing. But early on, you noted this, and you were right, that it was forcing them into these threes that they just weren't making.
Yeah, and I think finally, you know, who is a good three-point shooter now on this team? Avery Bradley, Isaiah Thomas a little bit, but he's going to have the ball in his hand, so there's no one for him to really kick to. He actually was 3 of 11 on threes. Jared Zollinger actually was 1 out of 4. Smart was 1 out of 8. I mean, I think the evidence is really mounting that his hot streak at points last year was fool's gold, and he's just not a good three-point shooter until further notice. And Jerebko was 2 out of 5. Evan Turner, not a three-point shooter. Rozier, Cody Clark can hit a three, but, you know, he's not going to play that much. So really, the lack of shooting there, 8 out of 32 on threes, was a problem. And then they just started trying to jack up shots in the lane. And when you have Jan Mahinmi and Miles Turner in there waiting, or just even bigs like Lavoie Allen and Jordan Hill were effective just because they were able to kind of camp out in the lane. That's why you saw that miserable shooting on shots at the rim.
Yeah, I think they were 1 of 10 when Lavoie Allen was the closest defender on shots at the rim.
Lavoie, plus 19. Jordan Hill, plus 17.
Granted, a lot of that
Jordan
was
Hill
playing
also had 15 points.
The weakened Boston bench.
Yeah, and although, in fairness, we should note that Frank Vogel decided to stay with those guys since they're playing so well with them. and therefore they were able to close the game out and looked pretty good doing so. The last play of the game, really, while it was competitive, Boston, I think, was within seven, and either six or seven, and Vogel set up a beautiful after-timeout hammer play. For longtime listeners know what that is, but for those who don't, a hammer play is basically where you'll try to drive to along the baseline on the strong side, and then on the weak side, because the help will be activated, you have a big set a screen on whoever is guarding the weak side wing, and that guy will flash to the corner for an open corner three. And so that was they set that up for Paul George, but the hammer play was really well disguised. They did a dribble handoff to, I think it was Monte Ellis, and Monte threw a great pass as he was falling out of bounds to George. George drained the three, and that was pretty much the end of the game. The Celtics tried to foul and get back into it late, but never got within a possession after that.
Is there anything else you want to say in this game, or do you want to move on?
Let me take a look at the notes here. Miles Turner shooting threes with no hesitation, hit one of them, but above the break. The fact that he's even spotting up out there is good, kind of getting away from some of the long twos. He had some rookie mistakes, though. Like, he got ducked in a couple of times, had some somewhat silly fouls, so I understand why he didn't finish the game. Mahimi, I thought, played well.
He did.
But that combination of Hill and Allen inexplicably was rolling, so... the Celtics also had their own play that Indiana really struggled to stop, which was basically a flex action with Avery Bradley and Isaiah Thomas, and the Pacers really refused to switch that, and because I think they just didn't want to get Monte Ellis on Isaiah Thomas, and so they were able to get, the Celtics were able to get three or four backdoors off of those plays, but that wasn't as good as the play that they couldn't stop those down screens for George.
I thought it was interesting in that, so they had Marcus Smart on Paul George, and then from what I recall, they were putting Avery Bradley early on. They were putting Avery Bradley on George Hill, and then Isaiah on Monte. I assumed it would be the other way around.
Yeah, that is a little bit of a surprise. They may have just wanted to get the cross match in transition and try to free up Isaiah a little bit. And he struggled. He was only 5 out of 18, but he still gets to the line. He had 8 assists. He still had 21 points on 22 shooting possessions. So even it shows you his level of efficiency, that even when he shoots 5 of 18, he cannot be a complete disaster. He's more efficient overall than the team was. I mean, that's something that I'll look at too every once in a while. You can say, oh, this guy is gunning. But if you have a more efficient night than your team does overall, it's kind of hard to criticize shot selection, especially when you're the one responsible for creating.
Yeah, and Monte didn't have a great night either, so it wasn't like they were exploiting that really in any particular way.
Yeah, maybe they just wanted Monte to shoot. And Monte actually wasn't too inefficient.
No, he's 5-12.
And 4-4 from the free throw line. Actually hit 2 out of 5 threes, which you're not going to see that often from him. All right, let's move on to what was a disappointing loss for the Milwaukee Bucks. They got destroyed by a very, very shorthanded Raptors team, 107-89, and the Raptors actually led by as much as, I think, 25 points in the fourth quarter. It was a three-point game at halftime, and then the Raptors just took it to the Bucks in the third quarter, outscoring them by 12.
Yeah, one thing I thought was interesting, you watched a lot more of this game than I did, was Jabari guarded by Scola most of the time, or was that more of an isolated thing?
Well, whenever Scola was in with those two starting units, I mean, this was the starting lineup for the Raptors. It was Lowry, DeRozan was out, so they started Norman Powell. Obviously, Damari Carroll is still out. They started James Johnson. Then it was Scola, and then Valanciunas is out, so they started Biombo. You wonder how that they're ever going to score. Milwaukee's actually been defending okay recently, but it was a pretty desultory Milwaukee effort on defense, especially in that third quarter. Second and third quarter, they gave up 30 points in the second quarter as well after leading by 6 after the first. That was one thing they really failed to exploit. I mean, I don't think they ISO'd Jabari on Scola a single time. And obviously, you know, the Bucks struggle for spacing, so an ISO might not be all that effective. They failed to punish that matchup, and definitely very disappointing for the Bucks, especially since they actually came out looking pretty decent with a 6-point lead after the first quarter.
And somebody else we talked about very briefly in the 15 and 60, Tyler Ennis, he played 14 minutes in their previous game and only put up 3 shots. At least this time he put up 8 shots, which is better considering Lowry was letting him shoot.
Yeah, he played 28 minutes, and the Bucks, it kind of got away from the Bucks right at the start of the third, and then it really got away from them when Ennis came in for Jared Bayless, who was in foul trouble. Kyle Lowry was not guarding him at all. Ennis still only got up 2 3-point attempts, despite the fact that they weren't guarding him on any possession. He had a couple other buckets in garbage time, but really did not look good at all. Was negative 13 in his 28 minutes. Still seeing very little evidence on the court that he's someone who can be really an effective player. He had a couple of nice defensive moments, but overall, Lowry just killed the Bucks. He was 5 of 9 from the field, but shot 11 free throws and also had 11 assists. He was taking charges, so 25 points, and he was a well-earned plus 21, which led the Raptors in this game, and he also was instrumental in getting out in transition in the third quarter, which was something that really killed the Bucks.
What did you think of rookie Bruin Norman Powell?
Yeah, he had a great game. What I would assume is a career high for him, 17 points, and he was instrumental in that run, an 8-0 run that started the third quarter. He forced Giannis, in addition to a little bit of help. He was actually guarding Giannis in this game at 6'3", 6'4". That was pretty impressive. He did well on him, looked good getting over screens, forced him into a couple of misses, and then just on one play just ran it down the Bucks' throats as Greg Monroe didn't get back. And just went by the entire team and just dunked it. And then the next time he got a corner three as Lowry pushed it, and that got them out to a 10-point lead that they essentially never relinquished. So, I mean, just impressive that Powell was able to go 3 out of 7 on threes, 6 out of 15, not an amazing percentage, but the fact that he even was able to get up that many shots is encouraging. Played 34 minutes, and his defense is definitely there where it needs to be. So if he can shoot threes, he's someone who can be a valuable player for them, and they have him under a very, very favorable contract for some time to come.
From what you've seen so far, I've bounced around on this. Do you see him more as like I see him as more of like a 2-1 defensively, so, you know, a natural 2 who can defend point guards. But if he can guard Giannis, that makes his potential a little bit different.
Yeah, he really competes. He's really athletic. He's got good length for his size. He's strong as a guy who came out of UCLA as a 4-year guy. So I think certainly most threes he can guard. And he did okay on Giannis, even when they tried to post him up on occasion. He's going to need help against some of the bigger threes. But, yeah, I mean, if you're having him guard just a normal three who's not really going to bludgeon you in the post, I think he would be fine in that role. I wouldn't want to be, all right, we've got this guy's our starting three. But I think, you know, if you're going to switch 2-3 with him, you're not going to be dead in the water for that possession.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what his role is on this team, but it's been very encouraging to see him thrive when asked, which hasn't been necessarily consistent, especially in today's game because of DeRozan being out.
We talked about yesterday, I asked the question, are they better with Biombo or with Valanciunas? This was a big data point for me in favor of Biombo. He was fantastic defensively. He actually had 13 points on 7 shots. And 13 rebounds as well. His hands have really improved quite a bit. He had a couple of really nice moves, one up and under, another spin move for a dunk when he caught the ball on a rolling to the basket. It really, really looked good. And it's too bad that he probably won't be a Raptor after this year because they're going to have to use cap space that they might not even have to re-sign him at this point. His price tag is going up the longer he plays with Valanciunas being out. And it's going to be a real interesting decision for Dwayne Casey, especially if they get down in a series, he may just go with Biombo. I still like your idea of giving Valanciunas the quick hook and then playing him at when the reserves come in and trying to use him as a source of offense. But yeah, the Raptors did not particularly miss Valanciunas or DeRozan in this game, which is somewhat interesting to think about. But, you know, this was only one game against a Bucks team that, you know, probably took them a little bit lightly.
I hadn't considered this until now, but there is a little bit of appropriately cruel irony that they could be burned by not having full bird rights on a guy that they got on a cheap contract when that's exactly how they got Damari Carroll from the Hawks.
Yeah, well, in this, they don't even have early bird rights, right?
They're non-bird.
All they'd have is just the non-bird, 120%. So that's not going to get it done. And, you know, but I mean, we could also see them potentially move on from Terrence Ross or even Valanciunas this offseason, depending on what ends up happening.
Or even DeRozan if he chooses to go somewhere else.
That's a great point, too. So they could look a lot different. And I mean, that's another reason why there's so much pressure. I mean, there's pressure on Casey, there's pressure on Masai, and there's pressure on the whole organization to kind of keep these free agents in the fold, and winning is definitely the best way to make that happen.
Certainly is. Speaking of two teams that have done a lot of winning recently, well, overall, the Clippers, the Clippers went to San Antonio, and there are a couple of different takeaways that I had from this game, but I want to start with something basic, which is, do you want to see this series again? Because when I watched this game, I was just sitting there dreading the possibility of that being the 2-3.
Huh, that's interesting, actually. I actually think that this would be, well, I guess seeing KD against Kawhi would be pretty awesome, but I think Warriors-Thunder has made for some very compelling basketball also. I think with Blake back, it could be a lot more interesting. That the matchup one-on-one of Blake and LaMarcus, I think, would be absolutely fascinating to see who would get the better of that matchup. So we didn't see Blake, but yeah, I don't think that the Clippers would be able to give the Spurs much trouble given the matchups that currently existed. Maybe Blake could change things around. Of course, that would require Doc Rivers to actually stagger those guys because, you know, DeAndre Jordan was only -2 in this game. Chris Paul was +2, and they lost by 21 points.
Yeah, John Schumann pointed this out during the game, that during the relevant portion, because it was, I think it was at the end of the third quarter that he mentioned it, the Clippers were, I think they were -20 when Chris Paul was off the floor. Yeah, they were -20 in 10 minutes and 16 seconds when Chris Paul was on the bench, and that was in the, you know, the part of the game that was relevant.
Yeah, that's not good. Prigioni, Wes Johnson, Jamal Crawford was only 1 out of 9. Austin Rivers was 1 out of 5, including an epic sprite that ruined maybe the best pass of DeAndre Jordan's career. And,
wait, did you is, know, is a sprite the term for that?
Yeah, like, you know, Grant Hill drinks Sprite. You remember that commercial?
Yeah, I never heard of that as the term for it.
Yeah, well, as someone who's experienced a Sprite or two on occasion, I've certainly been told that that's what it is by the people who made fun of me after it happened.
I've never had the privilege, so unless I haven't gotten to trampoline dunk, so.
Yeah, it was only a 1-point San Antonio lead, actually, going into the fourth quarter. And, of course, that was the time when Chris Paul and DeAndre were on the bench. And right away, it was just over. It was a 12-2 run in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds to basically put the game out of reach. And then even when Paul and DeAndre came back in, which Doc desperately brought them back in, they weren't able to stem the tide at all. 37-13 final quarter for the Spurs in this one.
Cool. And I thought Kawhi played really well. We should also mention, I can at least pimp it, I'm sure if you read it, you'd like it too, was Lee Jenkins' piece on Kawhi was really great.
Did he actually get him to talk?
Not much. But I think that's kind of why it works, is it's coloring in the rest of his story. And I mean, I was thinking back to it from the times that I've tried to talk with him, and I don't think I've ever gotten a notable answer from him, which is not a criticism, it's just he's a different dude.
For the Spurs, one notable stretch for me, you mentioned Kawhi, was the Clippers actually were hanging in real pretty tough through the second quarter, and the Spurs got out to a little bit of a lead during that time, basically just ISOing LaMarcus or Kawhi every time. And there was a stretch of like 4 or 5 possessions where the Clippers just had no answer. And this wasn't even when they were dumb enough to put Jamal Crawford on him at one point in the fourth quarter. I guess they were just trying to come back with Paul, Redick, and Crawford by that point.
Oh, my God. But I just realized their initials are CPR. That's great as a lineup that you're trying to resuscitate your offense.
That is really good, actually. The CPR lineup, that's, yeah, but, and, you know, sometimes it also might do a little bit more harm than good, because sometimes when you're doing CPR, you, like, end up breaking the patient's
sternum. Yeah, but they'll need a rescue breathing lineup, too.
So, but anyway, back to what I was saying about Kawhi, he abused Wes Johnson, drove baseline, just knocked him out of the way, and then did a sweet reverse pivot for a layup. The next time, he made a sweet step back on Jeff Green. Then he posted up on Redick, somehow got on him, and then they got a wide open corner three for Parker, which missed, but it was still a great shot. And then they went to LaMarcus a couple of times, and they got 4, 5, 6 great shots in a row, just ISOing, nothing fancy whatsoever. But then that bench unit comes in, and they actually play much closer to sort of the Spurs-gasming that we have come to see from this team.
And that was a real juxtaposition with the Clippers lineup that, well, you know, they have creators. It's not that's not the issue where the ball necessarily stagnates, but you're right. And it was notable, you know, that the Spurs don't have that ball movement necessarily in the starting lineup, because one of the disparities that I noticed when I was looking at stuff after the game was that the Spurs had 25 assists compared to 15 for the Clippers, but they also had 8 hockey assists, whereas the Clippers had only 1. So that's, you know, that's not a perfect measure of ball movement. The passing was pretty similar, but in terms of productive passing, it gives you an idea.
Yeah, and Paul had 8 of those 15 assists, and I think it was even an even higher ratio before we got into garbage time. And that's what's going to happen when you only have one guy to make the play. You're not really moving the ball that much. You're going to get only one secondary assist. And guys like David West, he had a wonderful stretch to start that fourth quarter. Looked way more athletic than guys like Cole Aldridge. And Paul Pierce was out in this game, but not that he would have made much of a difference. DeAndre was out too. So West hit some jumpers, got on the offensive glass for some nice plays, was active defensively. He and Diaw worked together pretty well in this one. So West cementing his position as a six-man candidate. Patty Mills also was really good. And that was another thing for the Spurs in this game. They only got up 23s, which still is not that many. But Danny Green was 4 out of 5. Manu was 2 out of 5. And Mills was 2 out of 4. Manu actually continues to look really good. He had 13 points in only 16 minutes.
He was great
in this one.
And Manu just, this has always been true, but he just pops off the screen. And it was especially true against a Clippers team that doesn't really have the right defenders for him. And, I mean, not many teams do. Manu's amazing. But the Clipper, I kept on being struck in this game as much as Mbamute and, you know, Johnson, he does a little bit of thing, is that they don't have those guys. And so you think about if the Clippers were to face the Thunder, and, I mean, yeah, that's a benefit against the Warriors, but they don't even have a guy to put on Klay Thompson.
Yeah, it's not very good. We shouldn't obscure the fact that DeAndre Jordan did have a wonderful game in this one, though. And Pop did not go to the hack at all, but it was 16 points, 14 rebounds, 37 minutes for DeAndre, and just he had some stretches, especially in the third quarter, where he was just all over the place on defense, switching out on guys. He was guarding LaMarcus. He would step out on jumpers, force misses, get back to get the defensive rebound. This was one of those games where you actually feel like, all right, this guy is a legitimate defensive player of the year candidate. He still doesn't have as much of an impact defending at the rim as you might hope at times, and he will have a lot of mental lapses and not get out on shooters when that's what the scheme requires. But for this game, you certainly see why, you know, if you're someone who watched this game and 4 more of his games that were his good games, well, you might feel like, yeah, this guy is right up there as defensive player of the year.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add in on this one?
No. Should we get to some news items?
Yeah, less than usual that are injury related. Except for the first one.
Yeah, Pau Gasol will be missing a bit of time with a knee injury. Not a huge surprise. He's playing a ton of minutes. Also, in my opinion, not a huge surprise that they actually won without him, with that that Gibson Mirotić front court, which actually looked awesome against the Raptors. And of course, Gibson then said after the game that his injured hamstring was killing him during the game. That's never a good sign for a muscle injury. That's not the sort of thing that just gets better without resting some. But, we'll see. Gasol is still not traveling with the team. I think it sounds like the earliest he can be back is, you know, over the weekend.
I don't really have much more to add on that, you know, the situation. So I think I'll transition to what I thought was the most interesting story since the last time we did news, which is the piece that Brian Windhorst and Zach Lowe wrote on the crazy ownership drama that's going on in Memphis that is actually affecting Minnesota.
Yeah, do you want to give a brief summary of that?
Sure. So Jeff Kaplan he's actually a venture capital guy in California, but he was a part owner when Para bought
Steve Kaplan. Steve Kaplan.
I'm getting first names just horrible right now. And Kaplan, so I'm just going to use last names. He was a minority owner when Robert Para bought the Grizzlies, and he was interested in basically selling that and becoming a minority owner of the Minnesota Timberwolves, who could eventually be on a track to take over the majority ownership share of that team. However, that transition is being delayed by an ownership scuttlebutt in Memphis that is related to Kaplan potentially having this really weird option where I think it's a year from now, where basically if things haven't really resolved, either Para can buy him out or he can buy Para out. It's not necessarily expected that that's going to happen, but the bigger issue is that it's delaying everything, and it's possibly changing what Minnesota is thinking about this potential long-term solution.
Yeah, and Kaplan had been considered the successor to Glenn Taylor. I think if you're a Wolves fan, you'd be rooting for that pretty hard, since Glenn Taylor has not been effective as an owner. And so this is going to be something to monitor for sure. And we've heard lots of reports of turmoil with the Grizzlies, that their ownership group, another one that doesn't really get along, they've done a very good job. You know, there was the Jason Levien thing where he was involved for a while and then now is no longer involved. Chris Wallace becoming the GM basically after he'd been put out to pasture and just was like talking on the radio in Memphis. He actually now is back to being the actual decision maker there. They've still been doing a pretty good job there, helped, of course, by ESPN alumnus John Hollinger. So that's one thing, at least, is that it hasn't messed things up too badly on the basketball court. There's also the Dave Yeager drama where, remember, there was talk that he was going to go to Minnesota to be the coach under Saunders. And then all of a sudden, Memphis decided, no, we're back and we want to give you an extension instead.
And he's doing a good job, too.
Yeah, no, he's been fantastic this year. If this weren't a year with two all-time great teams, you know, he would be in the coach of the year conversation to me. So yeah, this is probably something to monitor a little bit more. You know, Kaplan, the fact that his sale of his percentage to someone else is being delayed is now something that could potentially prevent him from buying into Minnesota and then eventually taking over. Because you obviously can't own parts of two teams at the same time. And if he can't divest himself of that part of the Grizzlies, and it sounds like he's kind of being held hostage there to where he might have to take a loss on it or not get as much as it's really worth, then, you know, the other owners really have some leverage on him if they're going to not let him do that, because they know that he wants to get out and get into the Wolves instead, where he could actually be a controlling owner at some point.
We can go from that to another Memphis injury. PJ Harrison, the guy who they one of the players they acquired at the trade deadline, is going to miss a couple weeks because of a strained left groin.
Yeah, just the beat goes on here for Memphis, I guess. Really terrible luck for them. They have no point guards. They have no wings. They'll probably try to get another injury exclusion spot if they can. Another interesting one per Pelicans beat writer John Reed. The Pels will not push to re-sign Eric Gordon in free agency, and that really casts a rather negative light on their inability to get anything for him at the trade deadline. I guess the only reason was that they thought, hey, maybe he can help us save our jobs / get close to the playoffs. That didn't happen because he re-broke his finger, and it wouldn't have happened anyway because they were so far out of it. And so even if you could have gotten a second rounder for him, which I would think they probably could have, although he did have a big salary, their inability to do that is really a shame.
It's very frustrating. And the same kind of thing with Ryan Anderson, though he's in a little bit of a different boat. Yeah, just getting some sort of asset for him would have been a real nice return. I mean, yeah, it would have been a huge help.
Phil Jackson, in a piece by Ramona Shelburne, was confirmed to have a mutual opt-out in his contract with the Knicks after next year, 2017. He is making $12 million a year. The thing about mutual opt-outs is somebody is always going to exercise it, right? Like, the deal is never going to just be perfect for both sides. Someone is going to want to either get paid more money or want to leave or want to fire the person. So if there's that mutual opt-out, you have to imagine that that's going to get exercised by one side or another at the conclusion of next year.
Have I ever mentioned to you that that's part of the reason why I want mutual options in the CBA? Is so just so agents would love it because it makes contracts look bigger, but it's a year that never actually happens. It's just mean, but it totally works. I mean, you see it in baseball contracts all the time. Like, you see these, oh, like, look at all this money, but half of it is...
Well, so why does it help anyone to have funny money that's never going to be realized? I think that's one of the most annoying things about football, is that all these reported contracts aren't real, and then you have to really dig through. I like the fact that it's simple in basketball.
Oh, come on. It gives us a job, man. Can't be simple. Has to be hard. should we talk about the other Phil Jackson-related thing?
Well, let's finish up with this first before the coaching rumors. The fact that now he doesn't have 3 years left on his contract after this one, being paid $12 million a year, but in reality only has one, that to me makes it much more plausible that James Dolan might just decide to get rid of him after this summer, after this season.
Especially if it's directly impacting some of their stuff, like he is really pushing for Rambis to be the coach or something like that, because if it's hurting kind of the long-term vision, especially now that they, to Phil Jackson's credit, have a long-term franchise piece in Kristaps Porzingis, if it's affecting that, then you could do that. But also, I couldn't help but thinking about the idea that if the Lakers decide to put themselves in a holding pattern for next year because they're thinking, you know, about potentially bringing Phil back, that the holding pattern might include Byron Scott, and then my heart got sad.
Yeah, that's not going to be good. And then bringing back Phil Jackson isn't going to be good either, because they're going to run the triangle, and that just, the evidence is really, really mounting that A, if your coach is anyone other than Phil Jackson, and B, if the year is after 2011, and C, if you don't have Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant and great supporting talent on your team, that offense doesn't really work in the NBA.
I think that's the takeaway now, and we could always be proven wrong, but I don't think so, at least in the near term.
So the other part that came out of this is that Phil is so much more engaged now. He tried to stay out of Derek Fisher's way. Derek Fisher then, you know, was really rewarded that by being even more standoffish, just like blowing off Phil's guys. He had brought over some of his own guys from Oklahoma City, you know, blowing off Jim Clemens and Kurt Rambis, not coming to a coaching staff retreat that Jackson had set up during the off season. And so now Phil went on the team with a road trip. You know, he feels more comfortable with Rambis. He's trying to get his influence felt a little bit more. It was even floated that he might consider coaching the team just during home games. That would be ridiculous.
It'd be such a mess. There's a reason why that doesn't happen.
And Frank Isola got a quote from Carmelo basically saying, nah, I don't think that should be accepted. I wouldn't accept that if that was the case. And that's right. And Isola then went on to say, all right, you know, what if the Knicks need one win to clinch a playoff spot and the last game of the season's on the road? Is Phil not going to coach him? I mean,
hey, you can try to bait Melo into waiving his no trade clause.
Oh, man. You know, it's too bad. I mean, Phil was a wonderful coach. I think he could even still be effective if he were at full health. But, you know, that's not the case. He doesn't really want to deal with the rigors of the job anymore. That seems clear. And so this idea of him coaching just needs to be retired.
I will say that it's nice that it sounds like he's doing better physically, because that was a big, big concern of his as he was, you know, that led him out of the chair and into the box.
Two more little things. Tim Frazier, who was with Portland for a while, then went back to the main Red Claws. Now New Orleans is going to sign him on a 10-day, and Jared Cunningham is also signing a 10-day with the Bucks. They need some help at point guard. He's not even really a point guard, but as someone who maybe theoretically can shoot it and be more of a gunner type, he could play next to Giannis with him running a lot of the point. So yeah, one more little feature I wanted to introduce. I don't know how regular this is going to be, but we're going to come across it. It's kind of inspired by the 538 Elections podcast, where they talk about good use of polling or bad use of polling. And this is basically going to look at statements that people make that are just kind of, you know, is it really supported by the stats or not? And so on the broadcast today with the Spurs and Clippers, Spurs color guy Sean Elliott implied basically that fouls are way easier to get now. He said, oh, you just get breathed on, it's a foul, or you stick your leg out and it's a foul. And, you know, I've never been one to really enjoy the kind of reactionism and nostalgia for days gone by. And this is a really bad one because, quite frankly, free throw rates are at an all-time low, and it is much, much harder to get a foul call than it used to be when you're going to the rim.
And that includes guys, I think they're a group of players that are very adept at drawing them now. So it's not like you have this sort of sampling where you have this group of players that aren't doing it. I think it's just the defenses are aware of how dangerous and potentially catastrophic it can be.
This is actually a big reason why Michael Jordan might not be as effective today, because back in the day, when he went to the rim, if there was body contact, the vast majority of time it was going to be a foul call. You know, even if you were vertical. And now the league just, I think, wants to cut down on foul calls. They want more action, and they want the games to be over faster, less breaks. And so if you're vertical at the rim, they kind of err on the side really of not calling the foul, where they used to err on the side of calling the foul. Now, Jordan was unbelievable at getting to the basket. You know, I'm sure he would still get plenty of foul calls. But it really, and I will say that there does seem to be less foul calls at the rim, and maybe more kind of tricks of the trade foul drawing, which I don't particularly enjoy. Like, I can understand where Elliott is coming from on that one, but in reality, this is about as low of percentage of free throws to field goals that we've ever seen in the NBA.
Yep, nothing more to add. Anything else you want to discuss?
Well, the last point on that is that people would say, oh, well, teams are shooting more threes now. That's why the foul rate is down. If you go to the rim, it's just as easy to get a foul call. But some research that Seth did recently showed that basically teams are exchanging long twos for threes, and that the percentage of shots that are at the rim and are inside have stayed relatively steady these days. And there are just as many jumpers being taken. It's now just threes instead of two-point jumpers. So that doesn't really hold water as an explanation for why free throws are.
Yeah, that's a great point. I thought that we'd already made it, but you're right that we hadn't. And yeah, that, and also that is something that, as he pointed out in that piece, I believe it was for Vice, that I think, or was that Ken Pelton talked about this? Ken Pelton had kind of piggybacked on the idea and talked about how he thinks it's helped the game, and I would agree with him.
All right, you want to do a one jersey real quick? Let's just do it like straight cold. I haven't even thought about this yet at all. What? Give me a team.
Boston Celtics.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man, that is a tough one. So we did this once before. We'll probably do it semi-regularly. It's just, if you had to buy a really nice, authentic jersey that's hundreds of dollars for a team to own as a fan, which one would you want to buy?
And there is a preference towards active players, though if you do not see an active player that is quote-unquote worthy, you are allowed to go outside of it.
I'd probably go Jay Crowder. Really, really cheap contract. I think he's going to be around for a while. He's good. He's scrappy. He's not the biggest star on the team. I mean, Isaiah Thomas would also be pretty sweet too, but he's not the biggest star on the team, but so he's got like sort of a little like niche hipster appeal to show, all right, I really know basketball. I appreciate this. 99 is kind of a cool number. Yeah, I think I'd probably go Jay Crowder.
Almost every single thing you said in that answer is why I would pick Marcus Smart. Unusual number, he wears 36.
I feel like he could get traded, though.
He could, but so could Jay. I mean,
And I worry that he's not going to be that good. Like, Jay Crowder is going to start at the three for them for the next, like, 3 or 4 years, unless they get just some unbelievable superstar and have to trade him. But I don't think that they would do that.
Yeah, I can totally see the case for Jay. I just have more of a connection as myself as a fan with Marcus, and I love his intensity, and I always like it when a guard gets after it the way he does. That's just something I enjoy.
Yeah, no, I really enjoy his game too. It's more to me, A, that he might not be around, and B, that his offense may never evolve to being beyond a bench guy. I'm really kind of depressed about his offensive development this year. I was hopeful after Summer League that we would see more creation from him, but he just has not been able to finish at the rim, create and pick and roll, as well as his college stats and play promise that he might be able to. And part of it too has just been that they've had Isaiah Thomas emerge, and he's just a way better point guard than Smart, so maybe he hasn't gotten that opportunity. Bonus question, what if you had to pick a past Celtics jersey?
Larry Bird, done.
Boring.
I don't care. I said in my AMA he's probably the podcast guest I'd want to have the most. I loved watching Larry Bird growing up. He's one of my favorites.
So would it be the one that, like, remember they had like those 2 years where the jersey was cut like almost like a wrestling tank top? Like, would you want that one?
No, I don't think I would prefer it, though it would definitely be interesting. I would also, one of those, I was thinking it would be fun to have either a Walton or just one of the people who were involved in that 86 team that's still in the league, like a Carlisle jersey would be kind of fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that would actually be pretty fun.
I think he would love that. Like,
We've seen dudes show up in, like, Steve Kerr Bulls jerseys to Warriors games lately. I think I'd probably have to go Kevin McHale, just, like, such a low post master. My pickup
that's
game
like
is
the
like
least,
the
post That's, like, up. The least surprising one for me. Like, you mocked mine for boring. That's who I would have guessed for you.
Well, that's not boring, though.
That's true.
Like Larry Bird is boring in the sense that, like, that's the one that everyone would want. Like, I feel like there's a bunch of guys who would be above McHale in the hierarchy.
And I love Bill Russell, too. My grandfather used to tell stories about going to watch him play when he was at USF. So I would have no opposition to that. He's the man, so. Yeah, the Celtics, yeah. There are so many good former choices, and you could go more obscure with that if you want. There's just a lot of amazing options. Or you could go if you wanted to be that kind of troll, either do Kevin Love, DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, the Celtics have way too many good jersey possibilities to descend into Lakers pick number 4 territory with the Sixers. All right, that's it. What else do we have to talk about? Are we done?
Well, so I can plug, well, I'll just mention quick, we talked about it yesterday, I wrote a book review of Jonathan Abrams' Boys Among Men. I always keep on wanting to say something else because it's close to Boys to Men. And then also I just released the podcast with Sam Vecenie talking about NBA draft prospects, and that's on Real Jam Radio.
Yeah, that's in the tournament, and I can't wait to start getting into the draft a little bit this year, but we got to wait for the NBA regular season to be over. Follow us on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA here. Danny is Danny LaRue. And also support us by downloading the Postmates app and using that Capspace code to get a free delivery. Postmates is awesome. New sponsor. I use it all the time. I went to them and got them to sponsor the show because I love the product, and I think you will love it too. You can get anything delivered to you basically whenever you want from any store. Doesn't matter what it is. All right. Talk to you all next time.